Hello, and welcome to Out on the Edge, the radio show where each week co-hosts Judy McCord, Robin Hamilton, and Betty Priu, queer elders with a combined century of lasting, loving relationships, present an all-ages tour of what it's like to be gay and gray in North Carolina in these interesting times. Today's guest is Dr. David DeMarini. He's here to talk with us about the biology of sexual orientation and a presentation on this topic that he will give September 3rd at the Seymour Center in Chapel Hill. Welcome, Dr. DeMarini. We are excited you are joining us. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout-out to WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM for hosting our show. Out on the Edge is brought to you by the LGBTQ Senior Resource Team of Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We're deeply grateful for their guidance and support. We acknowledge and honor that the town of Carborough and surrounding land was originally part of the Sapori People's Territory, which also included the Eno, Totelo, and Sikori Nation. Please join us each week as we interview special guests to share information, resources, insights, and stories for, by, and about our elders and the LGBTQ plus community. You can hear the show on the air Monday afternoons, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, or stream us live through WCOMFM.org. Our archive shows can be found at the Orange County Department on Aging website at www.orangecountync.gov/aging. In addition to links to the Out on the Edge show, the website provides a host of helpful resources and services for seniors in Orange County, North Carolina. Lastly, if you'd like to ask us any questions or suggest topics for future shows, please email us at outontheedgeradio@gmail.com. Thank you. Betty, Judy, on with the show.
Robin, thanks very much. Well, as Robin mentioned, our guest today is Dr. David DeMarini, recently retired after 40 years with the United States Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, in nearby Research Triangle Park. A continuing request over 10 years by various members of a local gay organization to prepare a talk about the biological basis of sexual orientation led David to investigate research done in this area. You can hear a lot about what David learned in this area on September 3rd at the Seymour Center in Chapel Hill. The name of his presentation that evening is The Biology of Sexual Orientation. We're delighted to have him on the show today to talk about his work and the presentation.
Thank you, Betty, very much.
Good. Welcome, David. So, first question. Reaching back a long ways, perhaps, what inspired you to become a scientist? What's your background?
So that's a great question. Thank you for asking. So I'm from Peoria, Illinois. I lived in central Illinois for the first 30 years of my life. And I was a theater kid in high school. Oh. You know, I play the piano, jazz, and danced and acted. And I was in several choirs. And, you know, I love the performing arts. But I actually had a deep and profound interest in science, and I took lots of science. So I'd be in the band pit in high school, you know, doing analytic geometry or calculus or whatever.
That's a pretty cool combination.
Yeah. And then it was my time to get up on the stage, I'd get up and do my part. So I was always conflicted as a kid what to do. And when I went to college, which was Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois, my thought was to be a theater major, and my mother, who was a nurse, was with me during orientation that first day, and she looked at me and she said, "David, you already know how to act, but you're really good at science and you really like it. And if you want to do science, you actually have to major in it. You can't just do it on the side like you can do acting." So I signed up to be a biology major. I thanked my mother 1,000 times over the next 50 years for that sage advice. And that's how I got interested in science. But there's one more aspect I should say before we move on. My senior year of college, which was 1972, I had to take genetics. It was required as a biology major. And there was only one professor who taught it. His name was Herman Brockman. I sat in the front row because everyone had said, "Oh, genetics, terrible, very difficult, you'll fail.
Terrifying.
It's going to be awful."
Yeah. One of those terrifying courses.
And after the hour was over, I was completely smitten with the topic and with the teacher, as a teacher, with Professor Brockman. And I ended up getting the highest A in his class and went on to work in his lab to do my master's degree with him. Mm-hmm. And several years later, he actually asked me to come back and do the PhD with him. Wow. He changed my life, and that's what catapulted me into a scientific career. So I owe a lot to him, and I should let you know, on Wednesday, I'm traveling back to Illinois for the memorial service for him. He just died a few weeks ago at the age of 90. I had the privilege of seeing him earlier this year, where we will remember him. So I owe my real start in all this partly to my mom, but also to Herman. He was a great inspiration.
Wow. So I heard you say by the end of this class, you were totally smitten. Do you have any memory about why? What
Yes.
caught you during Yeah. that class?
So I think, I'm a very kind of organized person. And in all my years at Illinois State University, I was there for 10 years off and on doing all three degrees. I never had a faculty member like Herman who in every course he taught, each time he came into the class, he actually had printed out and handed to all of us an outline, very detailed outline of what today's lecture would be. I mean, in great detail. And that kind of organizational structure appealed to me enormously. Mm-hmm. And I could also kind of see where he was going, what he was thinking. And I began to appreciate, in fact, the nature of that organizational structure and how it enabled him to communicate really complicated science. I mean, genetics mm-hmm. is not necessarily for the faint of heart to communicate that to us. And so that's what really captured me. It was the topic itself, mm-hmm. how important genetics was to all of us and to evolution and life on Earth, but just the way he taught it.
Right. All right, well organized and very clear and transparent, mm-hmm, is what
yes.
it sounds like. I had a few instructors like that at university, and
they are fantastic when you get one.
And,
yeah.
and if you could clone them.
Yeah. They're few and far between, but they are amazing when you get one. Yeah
I mean, college yeah. would have been a mind-blowing experience.
if you'd had more of them, yeah.
All
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Right.
Well, good. So it sounds like you had a really inspirational mentor.
I did.
That's,
and we remained friends all these 50 years, you know, close friends. Uh-huh. I saw him usually at least once every year
that's
for the last 50 years.
Yeah. That's powerful connection.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So we're going to move towards a little bit your the presentation and the research you've been doing. So I was wondering, what prompted your interest in studying the research done on sexual orientation? And to me, one of your presentations earlier, there seems to be some suggestions that gender identity are also biologically mm-hmm. determined, but I'm wondering, why did you get interested in seeing what research was done?
Well, as you noted in the in your introduction, I was actually pestered for 10 years by members of the Mary Renault Society, which is a gay literary society here in the Triangle. They've mm-hmm. been around since the 1980s. And to give a lecture on this topic, on the biological basis of sexual orientation. And for 10 years, I said, no, because first of all, I was way too busy with my own lab and my own research and papers and students and all the rest. I didn't have time. And I knew intuitively, because I had followed the topic off and on casually over the mm-hmm. decades, that it was a very complex literature and not exactly in my field. It's basically neuroendocrinology, obviously some genetics, and that it was going to be an effort to make that talk.
It was going to be work.
It was really going to be a lot of work. And then about 2 years ago, I could see light at the end of the tunnel with my own research. I only had 4 or 5 more papers to write and publish. And I finally said yes. So I carved out about 5 months of my life to plow through the literature. We can discuss how that all went, mm-hmm. and pull that literature together, synthesize it, organize it, and put it in a form that I felt a layperson, i.e. a non-scientist, could understand. Mm-hmm. So that's how it came about. I was basically coerced into doing this by many people.
Tested and coerced. Yeah. You hadn't used those words
before. Yeah, but I really was coerced.
But, you know, you're reminding me of how often I've thought it's really important for people who can really understand the science in the papers. And this doesn't happen enough either. It's very important for folks like you to survey the literature. Yeah. And then give the rest of us who are reasonably intelligent but don't have that scientific understanding information we can use or say aha to or say, oh, that's not what I expected. So thank you.
You're
for
welcome.
And I can understand why it took five months.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's kind of ongoing because new studies
it
pop
is.
Out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, this kind of leads into, you know, I'm sure you started seeing what the history of research in this area was, you know, and how long it's been going on.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's a great question too. So I was aware of some of this literature starting in the 1990s. That's sort of when some of the key papers in this field really caught my eye, caught my attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't very aware of the literature prior to that. So when I started exploring all of this, and by the way, the way you do this, for those of you who don't know.
Yes, please.
Yes, I will let you know. So there is a database of essentially all the biological science, some chemistry, but mostly biological science, of all the biological sciences science papers published in the world, maintained by PubMed through NIH in Bethesda, Maryland, paid for by your tax dollars. This has existed since 1996. It is the world's repository of all the papers in the biological sciences, medical science.
Okay, and so, but not just U.S.
No, worldwide,
paper.
Worldwide.
Okay.
And it's free. Everyone all over the world can access it.
Have they also retroactively gone back and
pulled in it goes back to the late 1800s, some papers, yeah.
Great.
And it's freely accessible, and it is used worldwide by every scientist in the biological and medical fields. All the time. That
okay.
is how you do a literature search in this in any biological field. You use PubMed. There mm-hmm. are other search engines, but it's PubMed. And so, yeah. So I plowed my way through PubMed, and I got lucky. I found there were three review articles in this field. The first one going back to 2014, and the more recent one was 2022. One was from a group in Canada, another was from a group in Belgium, and another was from a group in China.
So question, a review article, is that a survey of what has been done in
at that point,
area?
Yes.
Okay.
So these were surveys of the literature up to that point,
okay.
where those authors tried to synthesize that literature at that mm-hmm. point and put it in some organized fashion.
Okay.
So that was a huge help right from the start. And I was able to read those three review articles and get a very good overview of the field.
Yay, Internet.
Okay. Yay, Internet. Well, again, this didn't exist until 1996. And
it wouldn't have.
It wouldn't have before. Yeah. And so I couldn't have done this prior
it would have
to
been
that. No,
very
not
painful.
Possible.
Yes.
One of the questions you asked was sort of the genesis of this field and how long it's been going on, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually brought with me a recent paper that was just published last year where a group of scientists from actually several countries sat down and found every paper they could in the field, mostly using PubMed, but some other sources.
Right.
And they tried to make a graph to show how many papers in this field were published in a 10-year block going all the way back 100 years to the 1920s. And at least for those of you in this room, you can see that the graph doesn't start going up until the 1980s. And that's really when this literature really got going. And by this mm-hmm. literature, what I mean is studies on sexual orientation and sexual behavior from a biological point of view, not a sociological point of view, but from a biological point of view, particularly looking at the neuroendocrinology and the genetics of said behavior. So this is a relatively new field. It's only been around mm-hmm. about 40 years. And I would, before we move on to another question, I would like to just say how that all came about in the 1980s. So it came about partly because of the AIDS epidemic. All of a sudden, within a few years, there was an identifiable population of gay men.
Right.
Not that there hadn't been in the 1970s, but now there was a truly visible population of gay men.
Right.
And they got studied to death, literally, to understand AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
But in the course of that, emerged studies of their sexuality in ways that had not been done before that.
Okay.
So unfortunately, it was a terrible health crisis in this country that is part of the basis for the upsurge of research in this field. There was a second reason, and that is simply the tools available to do molecular biology really came on in the 1980s, particularly out of the Human Genome Project.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you could start to do DNA sequencing. You could start to look at gene expression, whether genes were turned on, turned off. Prior to that, you couldn't do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so those tools were brought to bear then on this question.
To see. If there were characteristics.
What the biological basis was. And so,
yeah.
So the all of a sudden there were the tools, and at least initially there was this population that you could study.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the convergence of those two things that the literature really took off in the 80s. And before we finish, I should say one more thing.
Okay.
This is actually a very, very, not only is it a very young field, barely 40 years old, it is not a big field. And again, everyone in this room here can see, I will say, that on average over the last 10, 20 years, there's not much more than 30 papers a year published in this field worldwide.
So is that a low number?
Yes, so to put that in perspective, I myself published 5 papers a year every year for the last 40 years, and I had a relatively small lab here at EPA in Research Triangle Park. I myself put out 5 papers a year. Very large labs here at UNC or Duke easily put out 10 papers a year, at least. 30 a year worldwide? Are you kidding me? So this is not a large research community.
Okay.
And it's for obvious reasons. It's difficult to get the funding, and these are not easy studies to do. Some are done in animal models, rats and mice and other, actually even fish, and rams, sheep. But all of this is very difficult, and it's hard to get the funding. And I should point out that the funding for this research here in the United States has nearly all come from NIH and NSF. From your tax dollars, and those funds have now been withdrawn for this area of research. It will no longer be done here in this country.
Yeah, not funded by our tax dollars.
Correct. And so hopefully the rest of the world will continue in this area,
okay.
But the U.S. has withdrawn its financial support for the researchers in this country to do this area, this type of research.
Okay. So. Well, thank you. Thank you. And so is there any particular country or region where this research was done more?
Yes. So there are some real, I would say, hot spots of research in this area. So one is Canada. Actually, there's several groups in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Another, of all places, is one of the smallest countries in Europe. It's Belgium. The head guy there, his name is Jacques Balthasar. He's now retired. He's my age.
Mm-hmm.
But his lab continues with run by many of his former students and postdocs. It's a really large research group there in Belgium. But other countries in Europe, Spain and France and England, and then Japan and China are the other big ones. China, actually, people might be quite surprised. They actually have been looking at the biological basis of sexual orientation also for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where most of the work is. It's a few European countries, was the U.S. and is still Canada, and then Japan and China. That's where most of this work has come from.
Okay, because I was kind of curious when you were talking about that. So, So I'm wondering, did anybody collaborate with you on putting all this together, putting your presentation together, synthesizing this 5 months of research you did?
I wish. So the answer is no.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is, not that I didn't have colleagues and friends who were interested, but nobody had the bandwidth, the background, the time, or the willingness to do what was required to pull, first of all, to find the literature, read it all, synthesize it, and pull it together, and then organize it in a coherent way to present to non-scientists. Nobody I could add or talk to was willing to help. So I did it all myself. But mm-hmm. but in fairness, once I had done a preliminary draft of all of this, I did engage a number of colleagues around the United States, all over the place. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. Mostly geneticists, but other people, to hear what I had or see what I had.
Kind of a peer review?
Yeah, peer review of sorts, because I've never done anything without peer review. And to me, I would never go public with my own scholarship without someone else having reviewed mm-hmm. it. So they were very helpful. There were about 5 or 6, 7, 8 of them around the country. And they were really, really helpful. So. Well, but they actually didn't do the work. I did.
I get it. But, you know, the thing is, that's the reminder. Many, many minds can make work better.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so.
I'm very grateful to them. They were very helpful.
That's great. Yeah. Well, and am I right in thinking you were retired when you started
doing
this?
Yes, I was. Yes.
So your time did kind of free up at that point.
It did. It did. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I think a lot of us are finding retirement is kind of opening up.
It does. It opens new opportunities. I was very interested to do this for the last 10 years, mm-hmm. but I couldn't. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah,
finally, when you reach retirement, you're right. New opportunities appear, and if you have the courage to do them, and I had a lot of pressure on me to do this, so I did. So
yeah, it sounds like I think I know a few of these people who were badgering you about this, and good on them.
Yeah,
good on them.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to tell them thank you.
They deserve a thank you. Yes,
that's great. Okay, so. We thank you. You shared a lot of background around how this compilation of research and presentation came together. So does the research actually include one or many biological bases for sexual orientation?
Yes. So that's a great question. And I was pleasantly surprised. So but at the time I started this, I certainly knew there was a genetic component. I had seen some of those papers over the years.
And I would imagine the papers talk about the genetics as well as the hormonal, right? And
correct.
That's what you mean by the endocrine
endocrine system, yes.
From a very
hormonal,
non-scientist,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, no,
good.
It's hormonal.
So those two facets.
Correct. Thank you for that. So I knew about the genetic. I mean, some of it. I didn't know all. And I also knew about another mechanism that's called epigenetics. So epigenetics is whether genes are turned on or off. So all of us have 20,000 genes in every cell of our body mm-hmm. that code for 20,000 proteins. And actually, some of those are divided so that in the end, it's about 100,000 proteins that we make. But they all come from 20,000 genes.
It's kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is. But they account for only 2% of our genome. So what's the other 98% of your DNA doing? Well, for a long time, we didn't know. And it actually was called junk DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It's not junk anymore. Now what we know is that nearly all of it actually is in the service of coordinating and regulating and turning on and off the 2% of the genome that codes for the proteins.
Oh, so it's sort of like the programmer for the switches.
It is. It's exactly that. That's the analogy. And so it turns out gene regulation is what 98% of your genome is doing. Only 2% of it is actually coding for anything,
which is
protein. Yeah, it's regulating, it's controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew about epigenetics as also playing a role in sexual orientation. I think what I did not know was the role of immunology. And so it turns out there's a very interesting literature. It's mostly from Canada, but there are some other countries that have explored this. That also plays a role. So the short answer to your question is that it turns out there are three main mechanisms that underlie the biological basis of all sexual orientations. Straight, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, it's all the same.
Asexual, everything.
Asexual, everything. And what it is genetic mechanisms, these epigenetic mechanisms, the control of gene expression, and immunological mechanisms. So there are three main mechanisms, and of them all, the most important, as it's turning out, is the epigenetic mechanism, whether genes are turned on or mm-hmm. off.
Could you talk a little bit about what the immunological, what is that
yes.
exactly?
Yes, yes.
How would that?
So I should preface this by saying all three of these mechanisms all operate during pregnancy. It's all of sexual orientation is established in utero during the pregnancy, so that once the person is born, whatever their sexual orientation is what it is. There's very little evidence that external factors after the person is born, either exposures to chemicals, to hormones, behavioral things, how your father talked to you or teacher treated you or whatever.
Right.
There's almost no evidence to support a role for any of that.
Even with sociological studies and psychological studies?
Almost none.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
None. What you are in terms of your sexual orientation is established in utero. And that applies for all three of these mechanisms. Mm-hmm. They all operate in utero during gestation. The immunological one is very interesting. It probably accounts for no more than 15% of gay or lesbian people. So only about 15% of gay or lesbian people are gay or lesbian because of this mechanism.
Okay.
So it's a minor mechanism.
Okay.
Epigenetics is the major one. Next would be genetic mechanisms. And the least common is the immunological one.
Mm-hmm.
But what it is very interesting, is that in some mothers, while they are pregnant, and it's not all, but some, they develop an antibody against a protein coded for on the Y chromosome. So obviously this is a male baby mm-hmm. that has a Y chromosome. And for reasons nobody knows, some mothers develop an antibody against that protein.
That's where the immunology
comes from. And it
okay.
turns out, I won't go through the details here.
That's fine.
But it turns out that leads to a blockage, that antibody blocks that protein from doing what it's supposed to do otherwise. What it would normally do or typically do is tell the fetal brain, all of which are female to begin with, all fetuses and the brains of mm-hmm. fetuses are female up until about 6 or 7 weeks, at which point, if there is a Y chromosome, the genes on the Y chromosome turn on to start making a boy baby
okay.
and a boy brain.
Mm-hmm.
But if mothers have this antibody against this protein, it blocks that protein from telling the baby girl brain, you're going to be a boy brain.
Yeah, flip.
And so they end up with staying a female brain, even though mm-hmm. the rest of them turns into a boy.
So. Okay. Okay.
And so you could tell this also plays a role in transgender orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, and by the way, before we end this topic on the immunology, I should tell you how it was discovered. The immunology was discovered only fairly recently. What was observed for decades and decades and decades all over the world, not just in Western countries, everywhere, is that women who, in the course of having children, who had a lot of boy babies, the probability, when they had a lot of boy babies, even if they had some girls in between, but they have a lot of boy babies, the probability that the boys at the end of the line were gay was quite high. This had been noted for many, many years, more than 40 years.
Okay.
So that was the observation. And, of course, no one knew why, what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't go through the details here, but, again, it was a group in Canada that figured out it was this immunological mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really quite interesting. The way it works is that with each... this doesn't apply to every mother
right.
who's had a pile of boys.
15%.
Yeah, it's just a small percentage. Yeah. I mean, my mother had four boys, and the last one is perfectly straight and has two children and two grandchildren. But the way it works is that with each successive boy born to these mothers, there's a 33% increased probability that the next boy will be gay. And that just goes on up and up and up with each successive mm-hmm. Boy birth. It's very interesting. So that was the observation. And then later came the understanding of the basis for that. It's an immunological mechanism.
It's pretty fascinating. And I guess we need to remember, too, all of these things are interplaying at the same time.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
In one uterus.
Correct.
So,
yep. All in one uterus.
Yeah, because, as we talk about the tens and hundreds of thousands of genetic markers and things they can switch on and off, the interplay, it's one thing.
It's a very delicate dance, tell you.
And it's not one switch,
no,
I would
it's
imagine.
Not one.
It's like the interplay of how everything
is. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God,
yeah.
What a fascinating field to have been in, for your career.
Yeah, it was. It still is. I'm not quite done, actually. So,
You seem to have a lot of energy. I think you'll be playing in this for a long time.
Yeah.
And you can do the research you want now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's whatever.
Right.
So, earlier you basically said there is no real, I think, social, cultural, environment basis for sexual orientation being one way or another. I mean, really,
I can expound on that if you would like.
Why don't you? Because I'm thinking, there must have been studies that would have tried to prove that.
Correct.
As yes or no.
And they came up with nothing.
Yeah, and nothing.
So there are such studies, and they've come up with nothing. There's just very little evidence for a role of the social environment on sexual orientation. In my talk, I do present some really tragic, in some cases, extreme examples where certain groups, certain societies, whatever, tried to impose a sexual orientation on young children that was not what they really were, and they all failed. I mean, and some of these are really quite extreme. I'll share one story about one of them. So about 20 years ago, there was a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine where the authors had scrounged up and scoured up a group of 16, well, at that point they were men, but at one point they were babies, male babies in this country, who, when they were born, either had a malformed penis or, a few days later when they were circumcised, the circumcision didn't go well. And the doctors, now you have to realize we're talking the 1940s, 1950s.
Right.
Didn't know anything. And the doctors told the parents, well, just raise them as girls. And the parents dutifully did. So these little boys were raised wearing dresses, given female names, raised as girls.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, usually around the age of 10 or 11 or 12, their hormones start to come on because they were all just boys. And they knew they were boys. And then they really knew they were boys. And they all ditched the dresses and chose a male first name and went on to live their lives as heterosexual males.
So they transitioned, kind of.
Well, they kind of transitioned.
Yeah.
And today we would view this as a gross violation of human rights. But this was done out of complete ignorance back then. No knowledge whatsoever of how, or even what sexual orientation really was.
Right.
And there's other examples, but that's one terrible one, to illustrate that even under extreme conditions, where right from infancy, a child is forced to be a particular sex or gender that they really are not, it never works. It never has in any culture, no matter what. And so there are other extreme examples like this, and either also examples where adults are given all kinds of hormones and things. I won't go through the details. None of this impacts sexual orientation. None. Now, there is one example. There was one category where the environment does play a role, but it isn't the social environment. So some of your listeners may have heard of a class of chemicals called forever chemicals or endocrine disruptors.
Right.
They are in everything. They are in all of us in this room. They're in the bloodstream of every one of your listeners. They're in your urine. They're in all your food. They're in the air. They're in all water. They're everywhere. These are basically plasticizers of some sort or another. And we call them endocrine disruptors because they disrupt the endocrine system, which is the hormone system.
Okay.
So it turns out there are, inadvertently, of course nobody did these studies, it was it was after the fact, of women during pregnancy being exposed to these in one way or another. Some were in drugs, which are no longer on the market. They were pulled. Others were just accidental exposures.
Environmental toxins. Right.
But exposed to endocrine disruptions during their pregnancies. And it turns out that those pregnancies result in an enormously high percentage of children that turn out not to be heterosexual. They're trans, they're gay, they're lesbian, they're bi, but they aren't straight. And we're talking like 75%.
Wow, that's
way off the map. Yeah. In subsequent years, studies have been done in rodents particularly, but other organisms, to expose the rodent while the rodent is pregnant. And it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. A huge percentage of the offspring are having same-sex behavior and things like this. So it's very clear now that endocrine disruptors at a certain level of exposure during pregnancy can influence the sexual orientation of the resulting child.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty powerful.
There is a role for the environment. It's rather narrow, rather specific, rather extreme. But there seems to be almost no clear role for the social environment.
Okay.
So.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. What about other behavioral physical features of people associated?
Yes, this is a great question.
Yeah, with sexual orientation.
Yeah, this is a great question. I won't go into the details here. I will sort of...
I've seen your presentation.
You've seen the presentation.
And
so
you had really wonderful...
Yeah, you sort of have
that.
To see the graphics to appreciate some of this. But I will share with you the headline on some of these. So it turns out the ratio in length between your second and fourth fingers, relative to each other, whether one is longer or shorter than the other, turns out to be impacted to some extent by the amount of testosterone that you were exposed to as a fetus during pregnancy. And female babies are exposed to testosterone, too. It's not like it's only boys. And using that as a surrogate... for understanding how much testosterone you were exposed to as a fetus, turns out to be highly correlated with all sorts of things. So
it's not really even a rough indicator.
Well, it's a somewhat rough. It's a pretty good indicator, actually. Uh-huh. Yeah, of exposure during development to testosterone. So it turns out, for example, a male with the more female ratio of length of the second and fourth fingers relative to each other, with the more female ratio, tend to have what is called more gender non-conforming behavior. So it's little boys who like to wear dresses, play with dolls, play with little cook stoves, rather than play with a Tonka truck, you know? And same for the girls. It's girls who would rather play with the truck rather than with the doll. So it turns out there is an association just based on that. By looking at that, you can infer whether the fetus had a high or low testosterone exposure.
Okay.
And then it turns out that's highly correlated with gender nonconforming behavior or not. And I can go even one step further to say that when it is related to gender nonconforming behavior, it turns out a person with the more male ratio of the second and fourth finger digit lengths, but the more male one is almost always the top in the whatever relationship they're having. They are not the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So again, these are secondary characteristics.
Yeah, it's behavior.
It's behavior.
Yeah.
There are other things that are more subtle. So it might interest your listeners to know about 10% of the world's population is left-handed. About double that percentage of gay men are left-handed, and almost 90% of lesbians are left-handed. And all of this has to do with testosterone exposure in utero during fetal development, okay? That's related to sexual orientation. Very interesting. And the last one I will mention, because I know all your listeners will be intrigued to know this. So at cocktail parties, people make jokes about how good or how bad their gaydar is, whether they can tell whether someone's gay or not. Well, you won't laugh about it any longer if you know the following. It's actually not a joke. It turns out it's real. And it turns out that over the decades and decades and decades in many, many cultures, many ethnicities, people have done what are called facial morphometric measurements to look at the size of the nose, the distance the eyes are between, you know, where the chin is.
Can you tell if you're a criminal?
Criminal, yeah.
Space between your eyes.
The space between your eyes, all that kind of thing. Yeah. So there's a huge database about facial morphometric features for all ethnic groups. And it turns out, when you sort those out by sexual orientation, lesbians and gay men have distinctly different facial morphometric, statistically significantly different facial morphometric features than, you know, gay men versus straight men or lesbian versus straight women. And over the years, people have made digital faces showing this gradation of features and showing those to panels of just regular people and asked, you know, which one would you guess might be gay? Which one might you guess would be lesbian? So guess what? Out of just the general population who look at these pictures and take that test, they get it right 75% of the time. So gaydar really does exist, and it exists because there really are statistically significantly different facial morphometric features between gay men and straight men, between lesbians and straight women. And over time, many people in a population begin to very subtly associate those facial features with the fact that that person is gay or lesbian, and so there really is gaydar. So these are all secondary features associated with sexual orientation development in utero.
Yeah, right. And, you know, as you're talking, I'm also thinking, you know, I think sometimes people think that equate testosterone with male and estrogen with female. And there's always a mix.
It's a mix.
Right?
It's an absolute mix.
Even in us sitting here right now.
Correct. It's a mix.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's more complicated
it's
than one
complicated.
Or the other.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad because I know we joked about gaydar went in the 70s.
No, we all just thought it was funny, but it turns out it's real.
Well, it seemed to work.
It did work. Yeah.
So is there anything in the research that surprised you?
Yes. Oh, this is a great question. So as I said before I started, I was certainly aware of the genetic and epigenetic mechanisms to some extent. I didn't know everything.
Right, because of your background.
Because of my background as a geneticist. I think what really surprised me was the neuroanatomical data. So these are studies of literally brain slices and neuroanatomists looking literally at the brain, under a microscope.
Is this like post-deceased?
Yes, after people
MRI
are deceased. Yes. They're not doing this on live persons. No. It's deceased. But also doing it on rodents.
But you know, you can do these
Yes, you
days.
Can.
You can scan.
No, but and then also scans, certainly.
Okay.
MRIs, functional MRIs and PET scans, of the brain, of living people, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the discovery, which I was not fully aware of until I started looking into all of this, all of sexual orientation and all of sexuality and all of sexual behavior resides in one very small region of the brain. It's the hypothalamus. It's about the size of a walnut. It's in the ancient part of the brain. It's at the base of this is the stem of the brain. Dinosaurs, alligators have a hypothalamus. Everybody has hypothalamus. It's a very ancient part of the brain. And it turns out it's not just the hypothalamus. It's a few very discrete regions within the hypothalamus. Some are involved in sexuality, and whether you're like a boy or a girl, and others are involved, other regions are involved in sexual orientation. It's that distinct.
Okay.
And I did not know or appreciate how specific in the brain these regions are where sexuality and sexual orientation reside. But it's very, very specific. And this has been confirmed through a variety of amazing studies using MRI, functional MRIs, PET scans in living people, as well as neuroanatomical studies anatomically. after the persons are deceased.
What's fascinating about this level of detail you just discussed is, you know, we've been interacting a lot as senior queers with younger queers, okay, who are like in their 20s or so. And for them, I know one thing that really struck me as a senior is, for the younger folks, sexuality, their sense of gender really is very separate from their sense of correct. Sexual orientation, right. affectional preference.
Correct. And they are distinct. And they actually are.
They
in
are,
your brain, they
are
really are distinct.
Distinct in your brain.
Could I tee off of your comment just for a second? So you raised the issue of intergenerational communications mm-hmm. between queer people, and I think this is a very important thing for everyone to be engaged in. But I would like to share with your listeners a very telling survey about intergenerational queerness. Mm-hmm. So for the last 13, 14 years, the Gallup organization, which most of your listeners would know is highly respected polling organization in this country,
right.
Has given a survey in this country for about 12, 14 years every year to people to assess sexual orientations. Very detailed survey. And they're all available. You go Google them over the years. You could see each one. What's remarkable is that over the last, say, 10 years, what they've also done is broken the responses down by generation. So people, for example, in my generation, people born in the 40s or 50s, mm-hmm. all the way to groupings of people in their 20s today. So what you find, for example, is that among the older population, say people in their 70s or even 80s today, in the U.S., mm-hmm. Only a small percentage identify as LGBTQ plus of some sort. It's quite small. It's about 2%. When you go to people in their 20s, it's 20%. Now, has biology somehow magically changed between 1950 and 2025? No, absolutely not. What has changed is culture, and it's made it more easy mm-hmm. for people to publicly, or even on a written survey, identify who they are, or even come to terms on their own terms right. with who they are sexually, or their own sexual mm-hmm. orientation. So we see a dramatic change. It's a tenfold difference between the older generation, younger generation,
right.
in percentage of that population identifying as LGBTQ+. Okay. And I take it one step further. If we look at people who identify as trans, among the older generation, people born in the 40s and 50s, it's almost zero. I mean, it's 0.1%. It's incredibly
small. It's not like trans people didn't exist.
They almost didn't
we
exist.
Know they did.
Right. It's now 1%. In some surveys, it's 2%. Among people in their 20s who identify as trans. And the last thing I would point out to you is, and that's, by the way, it's a 40-fold difference between the older generation and the young generation identifying as trans over the last 10 years. 40-fold.
Okay. It's huge.
It's huge. Another one that's quite large is lesbians. It's a more than a 10-fold difference between older generation and the younger generation. It's mm-hmm. a 10-fold difference. The really huge leap is actually among bisexuals. So most people might not think that that's perhaps the most discriminated group.
but I would believe it.
They would say it's trans people. Actually, it turns out it's bisexuals. So it turns out among those who identify as LGBTQ, which is 20% of the U.S. population among 20-somethings, the vast majority identify, among that 20%, identify as bisexual is 60%. So about 13-14% of the U.S. population identifies as bisexual. Only about 4-5% are gay or lesbian. So bisexual is the main category of LGBTQ sexuality that exists. And this is a group that, in fact, has not come out of the closet.
Well, you know,
they are not.
I agree.
They are not.
I know coming up, you know, it was just gay or lesbian.
That's right.
And,
but reality is not that.
And I think, unfortunately, part of what we saw is that people who said they were bisexual were treated like people who had not decided which camp they were going to
but
go
But they really are bisexual.
Right.
To take it even one step further, it turns out that when bisexuals are surveyed deeply, it turns out The vast majority are in relationships, frequently with someone of the opposite sex. 80% of them have never told their partner that they are bisexual. So it's not that they have not just come out to their friends and family.
Right.
They have not come out to their partner. 80%. It's shocking. So this is, in some ways, the sort of the last bastion of queer liberation that really needs to be happening. It is very uncomfortable and difficult for people to publicly acknowledge that they are bisexual and not be incur some approbation from their friends and family or
not
society.
Be ridiculed. By the gays or the lesbians.
Correct.
Because that happens.
Yeah, so that's the other large group. It's almost 20-fold difference between the older generation and people in their 20s who identify as bisexuals. So,
Thanks for all that information.
Well, thank the Gallup poll for asking the question.
It's going to give us a lot to think about.
I don't want to get political here, but this has profound implications, certainly for this country. A poll like this has not been done in other countries, so we don't particularly have those data, although I don't think they'd be terribly different in other sort of Western democracies. But it has profound implications. What it says is that younger generation in their 20s, you know, at some point they're going to be in their 30s, some point they're going to be in their 40s. This country needs to understand that going forward, 20% of the population does not identify as heterosexual. That is a huge percentage.
Right.
So to pass laws and regulations and book bans and medical treatment bans and the list goes on and on and on is denying a biological reality, but it's also denying rights to essentially 20% of the population.
That's
humongous. And so I think this country particularly has a very, very, very long way to go and a lot of work to do to bring that 20% into the fold legally, as socially, culturally, economically, and all the rest.
Right.
But it's 20%. Going forward.
Well,
it's not 2%.
Yeah, and that's vocal. And then, you know, usually there are others who aren't in a place where they're willing to check that box.
Correct. It could be even higher than 20%.
It's likely an undercount. You've given us a lot to think about. Yeah. So, we've got a few more minutes. So I just would like you to talk a little bit about, you know, how would you describe the presentation you're going to give on the 3rd? And what are the kind of things you hope people take away, at least one, from that presentation?
Well, I have given this presentation about 5 times. to various groups, and the response has been identical for all 5 groups. So some have been exclusively scientists, others have been exclusively queers of one sort or another, others have been a more mixed kind of audience, some have been young, some have been old, but the response has been the same in this regard. Almost nobody in the audience could raise their hand when I asked at the end, how many of you knew, say, 80 or 90% of what I presented to you today? Not a single hand went up. And so when you ask what do I hope people will take away from this, is an entirely new body of knowledge and information that they literally don't have, that they didn't have when they walked into the room to begin with. And it's not their fault that they don't have it. The reason they don't have it is that the scientists in this field have, for very legitimate reasons in most cases, refused to step out of their own academic publishing and academic conferences to communicate the science as an op-ed in the New York Times or an article in the Washington Post or whatever.
They can't freely communicate.
They cannot freely communicate. And so the rest of you don't know this science. If you don't read neuroendocrinology journals, you don't know this science, okay?
That's by my bedside.
Right, by your bedside, right? So that's when you ask what I hope people will come away with, is that they will come away with a knowledge and understanding that they never had before, that biological that the biological basis for sexual orientation is the basis for sexual orientation. That the role of the social environment is very weak, very poor, maybe even non-existent, although I don't want to be too dogmatic about it, but right. The evidence for it is very, very slim.
Right.
It is a biological phenomenon, and it all happens in utero. It does not happen after you're born. Mm-hmm. And it happens in your brain, in the hypothalamus. Uh-huh. And if people could come away with that understanding, I think it would go a long way to changing the situation in this country. So mm-hmm. we have horrible anti-LGBTQ laws now, almost everywhere except right. the blue states. Mm-hmm. And those laws are passed out of ignorance. To my knowledge, not a single scientist in this field has ever been asked to come and testify before Congress, ever. There's not a single PhD scientist in our Congress today, neither in the House nor in the Senate. Not one. Mm-hmm. Not a single one. There isn't anyone even in the Congress, if they had testimony in front of them, who would probably appreciate yeah. or understand much of it. So right. my point is, hopefully this could translate into better legislation mm-hmm. based on knowledge rather than ignorance.
Right, and spreading the information like to us is the first step.
It's the first step.
So that we know what's going on.
Correct.
Wow. Okay. Well, I listened to your presentation once before, and I will be at the one you're giving
you're
next week.
Do it a second time.
Because
it was
full of revelations that I think are well worth it. So well worth the hour of time I spent there. So, David, thank you again for joining us to talk about your work today. I'm excited about this presentation again, so that'll be great.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
Great.
I appreciate
it. Just so that our listeners know, if anyone listening wants to learn more, please join us Wednesday on September 3rd, starting at 5:30 at the Seymour Center on Homestead Road in Chapel Hill. First, we'll share a potluck dinner together, and then we'll hear David's full presentation, The Biology of Sexual Orientation, with great slides and great insights. I assure you, you won't be disappointed. The event on the 3rd is hosted by the Project Engage LGBTQ+ Senior Resource Team, which is a project of the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. If you plan to attend, we ask that you register this week by calling the Seymour Center at 919-968-2070. The registration number again is 919-968-2070. Thank you, David, again for joining us today and for sharing all these insights you've gained from gleaning all this wonderful research.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. So that's our show for today. Let's wrap up. We would like to also thank again WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM and the Orange County Department on Aging for making Out on the Edge possible. And we'd especially like to thank you, our listeners, for your support. Remember, you can contact us at outontheedgeradio@gmail.com. So join us again next week with Judy McCord and Betty Priu. And
goodbye.
I'm Robin Hamilton. Be safe, make noise, peace out.